Our view is that their modelling is flawed. I am confident in our numbers.
I think the National Party's economic credibility is in tatters here.
We're happy to release the full model, so tell us what part of the assumptions we've made that are incorrect.
If National can't find enough money, it leaves them three options: borrow more, cancel the tax cuts, or find some more public service cuts.
It looks like the preferred option is going to continue to be to bluster and to deny and hope that the news moves on.
We had Winston Peters over the weekend talking about some $5.6 billion haul. We've had Nicola Willis talking about these fiscal issues that you've been having for some time. It very much seems like your ministers are very softly downplaying the situation so you can come to the budget and say, this is what we wanted to do, however, we can't. So what's actually going on?
We've got, you know, inflation, we've got high interest rates, we've got a slowing economy, and we've obviously got a risk of rising unemployment.
Kia ora, I'm Alexia Russell, and today on The Detail, fiscal holes, a double-dip recession, a shrinking economy. The sheer weight of figures being bandied around is enough to do your head in. But how much of it is real, and how much of it reflects what's really happening? Here to help me wade through it all is Newsroom's senior political reporter, Mark Dalder. Welcome back to The Detail, Mark.
Thank you very much.
Now, look, I called you initially because you've done an awful lot of work on the size of the fiscal hole the government finds itself in. This, you've tried to quantify it. But things have accelerated a bit since then, haven't they?
Yes, it's never a slow day.
It's not just a recession we're in, it's a double-dip recession. New Zealand was going backwards economically for the most of last year.
The recession that we're in, the two successive quarters of negative growth, when you compare it to all the bandying about of this fiscal hole, which is worse?
I think it depends on who you are. A recession, in theory, is bad for everyone. It means the economy is not growing. But on the other hand, to some extent, this was an intentional recession that the Reserve Bank in particular wanted us to have in order to slow inflation when the economy is not growing, when people feel like their money's getting tight, they're not going to be going out and spending on things that they don't need. That brings prices back down, or price growth back down into a more reasonable range, and then the economy can kind of return to normal. The bigger problem on the fiscal hole side is if you're the government, because you're the person, in particular Finance Minister Nicola Willis, who has to make everything add up.
The economic forecasts for New Zealand are much worse than they were when we were elected. And yes, that is having a multi-billion dollar impact on the books going forward.
The government can affect the economy, of course, but the fiscal stuff is fully within her power. The fiscal situation is basically the government's budget.
What we said was that our plan overall was cautious and conservative. It had multiple elements to it, and we acknowledged that there would be some overs and unders.
Just like you've got a household budget, as Nicola would say, the government has its own budget, and they need to figure out how to make that add up.
But if someone pops up and they say, fiscal hole, it gets people thinking about whether they have the ability to do the job of adding it all up.
That's right. I think it's a challenge to the government's credibility. National campaigned on being, you know, a safe pair of hands for the economy, but also for the government. They were very, very strenuously insisting throughout the campaign that their tax plan would add up.
Our tax plan continues to be responsibly affordable. It continues to be something that we are going to deliver.
And that was in the face of basically all of the expert commentary that we heard from economists on the left of the political spectrum, on the right of the political spectrum, right in the middle as well, saying, no, this isn't going to work.
National's tax plan has come under scathing attack from a group of economists, both from the left and right, who have found that, at best, their foreign buyer's tax plan is short about $500 million a year.
And I think the situation we've seen in the months since the election has proven them right.
So it doesn't add up, does it?
No, it doesn't add up. And to some extent, the government can say, well, that's a result of coalition negotiations because we were made to get rid of our foreign buyer tax by New Zealand First. And that was one of the biggest critiques of the package, was that no one really thought that tax would bring in the amount of revenue that they had said it would. Now they don't need to actually go and put that to the test. That's a handy excuse for them. But there's still other elements that are coming in differently from what was promised during the campaign. They had said that the tax on offshore online gambling would raise $750 million over 4 years. Now it's closer to $150 million.
The gambling tax, which will not make as much revenue in the first instance as we had hoped, well, that's balanced out by the fact that the stop work notices on Labor policy programs, which we did in our mini budget, brought in $500 million more than we had forecast in our plan.
Stuff like that, which is a pretty big change, and the government is now trying to find ways to raise that extra revenue or cut that extra spending.
So you've done the maths. Let's just go back around and look at those in a little bit more detail. Okay, online gambling is one shortfall in projected income. What else hasn't turned out the way National expected it to?
So one of the changes is in the costs of the interest deductibility restoration, which is the kind of tax cuts for landlords is what you might have heard it referred to. Partly that's a change as a result of the policy itself changing as part of the coalition negotiations with ACT. The rollout of that policy has been sped up, but also the numbers are a little bit different because of changes in the housing market since the point at which National put their plan together. Another change is on the plus side for National is the working for families. They had promised an adjustment to the threshold so that people who are earning more money would still be eligible for that tax credit. They've scrapped that now, and that will save them about $550 million over 4 years.
It's not like a really good look, though, is it, taking money from poor people and going, yeah, you've got more money?
No. I mean, I think the difficulty for National is that raising revenue in general rarely is something that people enjoy. It usually comes in the form of tax. National has obviously very strenuously campaigned against tax increases, and so their options are mostly cutting things that are valuable and that people might deem to be, you know, important government services. I think the biggest political liability for National in terms of their revenue raising is the smoke-free changes.
Are you saying that the tax on smokers is going to fund the tax cuts? Is that what I just heard?
What you saw in the pre-election fiscal update was that Treasury assessed that the effect of drastically reducing the number of shops that could sell tobacco products, denicotising those products and introducing a range of restrictions would significantly reduce revenue to the Crown.
They're now planning to count that towards their tax package. It's $1.5 billion over 4 years, but it's a result of people paying more in tobacco excise than would have happened under the previous government's rules. National says that's not because more people are smoking, but just people are buying cigarettes in this scenario now from the dairy rather than from a black market. But it seems hard to argue that the changes won't lead to at least some more people smoking than would have otherwise.
What if it doesn't? Is that another hole they're digging for themselves?
Well, yeah, eventually, you know, we'll get more accurate costings, and the costings are constantly being updated. There's still quite a few policies from National's tax plan that we haven't had any updated figures for. The big one to watch out for is actually the tax cuts themselves, the income tax cuts. Those were estimated as of August last year, but now people's wages are going to grow differently from what was expected. Inflation is going to behave a bit differently. The economy is going to behave a bit differently. And so all of those things mean that the cost could go up or could go down, but it will be different from what was promised during the election.
What do they risk losing apart from face if they put a hold on the tax cuts?
I think it is just the political liability of it, that it's the one thing that they were very, very clear on during the campaign, that they would do these tax cuts.
Our tax plan's rock solid.
Even when they wouldn't say, we promise we'll pay for them in exactly the way we've laid out here, they did say, we promise we will deliver them. Nicola Willis said she'd resign if she didn't. I think it's just too politically difficult for them to back down. And so the only real source of cash left to fill these holes is further cuts to public spending, probably in the form of cutting public sector jobs.
What about pushing the timing out?
That could be done, but Nicola Willis last week did rule out doing that. She said people would get the tax relief that they had been promised in at the time they had been promised in the form that they had been promised.
It is the right time for tax cuts.
So kind of making clear that that election pledge was not going to change.
You were talking to me before about the doing the maths behind the fiscal gap. And what else did you discover when you looked into it about the figures?
Yeah, I mean, the total value of the difference between National's tax plan, which before the election they said they would, all of the revenue that they'd raise and the savings they'd make from cutting spending would basically fully offset the costs. They'd actually end up with about $115 million left over. I found that now, with the updated costings we've had and the policy changes that have been made since the coalition negotiations, the government now has $1.5 billion to make up for in order to get back to that situation where the tax package kind of pays for itself. The scope of my work was just on that tax package. There's broader sort of fiscal analysis that has also been done. I know Thomas Coughlin at the Herald found that the total gap the government is facing is $3.3 billion. A bunch of that comes from changes to indexing benefit adjustments to inflation rather than wage growth, which means people are going to get less in benefits than they would otherwise. National had expected that would raise around $2 billion for the government, or save about $2 billion for the government. But the updated costings that have come through have shown the savings are going to be much less. So that was never part of the tax package itself, but it is part of the government's sort of broader budget plan, and shows that $1.5 billion figure that I found is just one part of the problem that they're sort of facing.
Yeah, well, at the same time, the economy's shrinking, right? So less tax coming in to fund these policies.
That's right. So, the government's expected to have less revenue. Maybe, I'm not sure what the impact on expenditure would be. You'd think if lots of people are losing their jobs, there might be an increase in benefit costs and that sort of thing. But certainly the sort of successive updated projections from Treasury over the past year really have consistently shown actually the government is getting less in tax revenue than we thought we would. Now we think we'll get this much, and then the next month the statements come out and they say, actually, we got less than we thought we would. Now we think it'll be this much. And so that makes it, again, harder for the government to, for example, return to surplus. There's a lot of noise that Finance Minister Nicola Willis is making about the economic conditions, and it sounds to some economists like she might be kind of warming up the country for an announcement that actually they won't be able to return to surplus in 2027 like they had promised.
Has to be the one who finds some way of repairing the fiscal hole in National's plans.
How big is his hole? And do...
That is not in the public interest, I can assure you.
These concepts, a fiscal hole, a double-dip recession, how many of them are actual economic terms that mean real things, and how much of them are artificial constructs that are the work of political actors?
Yeah, a fiscal hole is kind of fictional. It can kind of mean what you want it to mean. There's no agreed definition of it. There is not, an economic definition of it. It's not a term that's maybe taught in economics classes. The fiscal hole concept was first, I think, introduced by Stephen Joyce at the 2017 election when he alleged Labour had a fiscal hole in their plan.
There has been a fairly solid backlash to Stephen Joyce's claim that Labour has an $11.7 billion hole in its fiscal plan. We've asked all the economists, where is it? They don't know where it is. Here's what the country's most respected economist said. Garnish Nana from Burl, who originally reviewed the numbers, says the alleged hole is, quote, fiction. ANZ chief economist, credible man, Cameron Bagri, says, quote, there's no hole. No one believes you, Steve.
No, that's
wrong. Do you still believe yourself?
Absolutely. There is absolutely mistakes that Labour have made in the putting together of their alternative budget.
Economists checked it. They found that there were no errors in there. It would be tight spending in the later years of the term, but that in and of itself does not make a fiscal hole. The National did appear to have some errors in their 2020 fiscal plan. Here came the allegation from Grant Robertson that National had a fiscal hole, and now it's become sort of a maybe too common term to describe any situation where things maybe don't quite add up. It doesn't have to be because of errors. There's not a suggestion that, in National's tax plan before the election, they made a maths error. they might have just been overly optimistic about how much money they might raise from certain things. Is that a fiscal hole? Some would say yes, National would say no. I think now we're at the stage where the term is kind of doesn't have a precise meaning beyond things aren't quite adding up.
So it's more of a weapon now. I mean, when Stephen Joyce came up with that and people said, six economists said, no, the figure's wrong, he didn't back down. It was too good a weapon.
That's right. I think it was very effective in 2017. It may have been effective in 2020 as well. Hard to know because there was so much stacked against National. Hard to piece out any one bit of what happened to blame for sort of their big loss that year. But given that it seems to be effective, I think parties are very happy to weaponize it, which does mean that it tends to lose a lot of its meaning, particularly if it is a politician saying it, when you've got economists or researchers or journalists who are coming up with fiscal holes or fiscal gaps or, you know, amounts not quite adding up. That tends to be maybe a bit more robust. But even then, there isn't necessarily a suggestion that someone's made a maths error, you know, that they've added the wrong column here or divided where they should have multiplied. It can be a more subjective kind of quote-unquote error.
This happened and we weren't expecting it, so there'll be less of this. And
exactly.
Kind of thing. Yeah. Vernon Small calls it a dark art.
Yes.
It's usually painting your opposition as having created some gigantic pothole in the road to the election that they can't explain, they didn't understand, and they couldn't do the maths to get right.
I think I would note, didn't use the term fiscal hole. I said fiscal gap in my piece as well. It's difficult, right? These are concepts that aren't explicitly defined in economic literature. And so basically what we're trying to find is a shorthand to say, this is how much money the government might need to find, or this is how much money they might be falling short of.
But terms like recession are heavily tied to actual figures, aren't they? Because there is a technical, there's an amount you've got to cross. You've got to cross into negative GDP, also a real term.
That's right. So recession has a very clear term. People have started appending the term technical to some recessions that we've seen recently. And that's a result of a sense that when we think about a recession, we think about things like the global financial crisis. We think about things like in New Zealand, the recessions in sort of the 70s and 80s, where the dire economic conditions were really visible. People were losing their jobs. You could see it happening. Homelessness increased. Like, it was an economic crisis, whereas the kind of technical recessions that we've had more recently have been accompanied by unemployment, yes, rising a little bit, but still being very, very low historically, you know, around the 4% mark, which prior to COVID would have been an immense success for any government. And so I think the use of the term technical is to denote, yes, we've met that requirement in the economic literature for a recession, which is two quarters in a row where the economy has not grown but shrunk a little bit, actually. But the percentages that we're talking here are, in the most recent quarter we've got data for, the December quarter, the economy shrunk by 0.1%, and the quarter before that by 0.3%. So we're not talking about a crash here. And in fact, even in December, the economy was still 0.6% larger than it was a year ago. And so broadly, the trend is still up. We've kind of dipped a little bit. But the expectation is that this is not the start of the 1930s again. We don't expect to see people lining up for unemployment checks. Yes, some people may lose their jobs, but it's not going to be a widespread phenomenon.
It's hard to separate the word recession from those kind of ideas and thoughts, though, isn't it? And I mean, what is the danger? Even though you say, all right, it's a technical recession, the Reserve Bank wants to drive down inflation, and so that's what's behind it. It's hard to get the emotion out of a term that now is not just an economic term. It's a picture of gloom.
That's right. I think the commentary around the economic situation has probably been a lot gloomier than maybe people are actually experiencing. I think the biggest impacts for people are still inflation. You know, prices are still rising above that sort of 2% per year mark that we've kind of taken as that's okay. And, you know, when I talk to people, other than people who work in the public sector. Their biggest concern is not losing their job, but how expensive things continue to be, whether it's groceries or the power bill or petrol. Those are the things that people are feeling economically. It is still the inflation, the cost of living stuff, rather than the recession, the declining economy.
Mm. We were talking about GDP before. Can you just explain for us exactly what that is? Because that really is a true measure of how a country's doing, isn't it?
So GDP is gross domestic product. It's basically the size of the economy, all the money that's spent in whatever period of time you're looking at. And so when the economy declines, when GDP declines for 2 quarters in a row, for 6 months, we consider it a recession. You say it's sort of the true measure of how a country is doing. And I think that's open to contestation. Some people would say that GDP is one measure of how a country is doing, and it is a solid measure of how the economy is doing. But some things don't really factor into the economy. You can't necessarily account for the costs of surgeries that you didn't have to do because you stopped people smoking earlier in their lives and they never developed a tumor that needed to be removed. Those counterfactuals don't work as easily into it. And then there are just things that we don't quantify or that can't be quantified that we still think are important, like happiness. Or, we might say, actually, one child in poverty is to us worse than one adult in poverty. And that's not going to be reflected in a GDP measure, but there might be other measures that we can say, actually, we should have a look at what the impact might be on children in particular, or Māori in particular, or any other group that could just sort of otherwise be subsumed. It's just one number, which is the size of the economy in dollars.
But Mark Dolder says many of these terms are really about headlines.
I would be curious to know if you stopped someone on the street or polled the average person, whether they remember the fiscal hole moment from 2017, and I suspect many of them would, and then whether they know whether it was true or false. Because very quickly after the allegation was made, the reporting was very clear that it was false, but that first headline tends to go quite a bit more widely than the second one.
I mean, the fiscal holes are a thing now in Australia, in the US, in the UK, France. I've seen headlines from all those places using the same words.
Yet another proud moment for New Zealand exporting an important concept to the rest of the world.
Yeah, yes. That's it for today. The details supported by RNZ and New Zealand On Air. Today's episode was engineered by Jeremy Ansell and produced by Gwen McClure. Thanks to Mark Dolder. I'm Alexia Russell. Kia kite.